thank you. Okay, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to assure Noah that the world won't be as fragile and as feeble and won't always be vulnerable to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's flooding it. Noah has to have his optimism restored. He has to be empowered. He has lived through a destruction. It's very easy for him to imagine that all of his efforts will be futile and wasted. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to give him that assurance. And Hashem gives him various assurances. One of them is that I won't ever curse the land again. Lo osif lekalel odes adama bavur hadam. Ki yetzer leif hadam ra min yirav. Because I know that man is patently evil and patently corruptible. And I know that if I allow the world to be victimized by human misconduct, then there'll be future apocalypses and future destructions. Interestingly enough, the Ramban says, before you get to Rashi, that Hashem didn't tell Noach this, because that would just be depressing. Hashem tells him, I won't ever destroy the world. He doesn't tell him because man is terrible. That we only discover at Har Sinai when we read Parshas Noach. But this conversation didn't take place with Noach, it's taking place with the reader. The only thing Hashem told Noach is, I won't destroy the world. Anyway, why does the Torah use the word ki yetzer leif ha'adam ra min'u'rav? It's a strange word, min'u'rav. So Rashi senses the word min'u'rav doesn't just mean from when you're young, but Rashi says min'u'rav, let me find the Rashi here. Pesach Havalev, excuse me for a second. Min'i'arav ksiv. There's missing, the vav is missing. It should be written nun ayin vav resh yud vav. The vav is missing. So it could be read ni'urav. It could also be read mishin in ar, let's say it's me me imo yitzahara. The man has a yitzahara when he starts to move. Lin'or means to move. When you move and exit your mother's womb, then your yitzahara is born. So the Torah intentionally writes the word ni'urav without the vav to connote that the yitzahara is born when a person is born. And why is this important? There was a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Tzedek Aleph and Beis, that has a machlokas between, or a conversation between, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and Antigonus. Antigonus, who was, of course, the Roman Caesar, who was a friend, very good friend of Rebbe's, on a very personal level. And Antigonus asked Rebbe, when does the Yitzhar begin to exert the influence? From the time that the baby exits the mother's womb, or from the time the baby is born? So Rebbe answered, from the time the baby is born, Shas Yitzira. And Antoninus questioned it, and Rebbe actually accepted that the Yitzhara doesn't begin from the time you're fertilized, but from the time you're actually born and you leave the mother's womb. So the same conversation in Rashi, that the Yitzhara begins when you leave the mother's womb, this conversation took place between Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and Antoninus. And interestingly enough, Antoninus proved to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi that it's when the baby is born. A famous question, whether man is patently good or man is patently evil. How did Hashem create you? A lot of modern novels have suggested that man is patently evil, and if left to his own devices, Orwell and Animal Farm, Golding and Lord of the Flies, some of the Russian writers, the man is essentially a flawed human being. And of course, Christianity creates an entire theology around it, that man is born into this world through original sin. So essentially, every human being that's born is a product of sin. Judaism rejects that completely. Adam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu asas Adam Tov, Shlomo HaMelech writes, Yashar, Ne'im b'kshu cheshbonot rabim. Hashem created every human being with Selim Elokim, and every human being is created Tov. V'yar Elokim is kol asher atzav v'nei Tov ma'od. And this world corrupts us. So this conversation as to whether the Yitzhara begins when you're conceived, or the Yitzhara starts when you're born, is a crucial conversation. That's what you're essentially asking in part is, is man created in the mother's womb good and virtuous, and then when you leave, you're exposed to all sorts of pressures and challenges and difficulties, so you sin? Or, if a person has the Yetzirah when you're conceived, then it's getting closer to this view, which we reject, that man is patently evil and patently flawed. And so it's very important for, at this, especially at this stage of Parshas Noach, this is already Bereishis Part 2. This is the second creation of the world. The first creation of the world presented the failure of man, the catastrophe of man. So now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was resetting human expectations, and resetting human expectations, at least for the reader, if not for Noach, who may or may not have heard this pasuk, is that your Yetzirah only begins when you leave your mother's womb. For those 9 months before you're exposed to this world and its challenges, you're patently good. There's no potential, there's no corruptibility. comfortability begins when you're exposed to the challenges this world presents. And man should be seen as fundamentally good and virtuous. And of course, even if you feel the Yetzirah is created when you're conceived, it doesn't mean you're patently flawed. It just means you have inclinations and predilections and challenges. It's just because you have the Yetzirah, that's not you, that's not your identity. That just means you have certain desires and needs. But this whole question, when the Yetzirah is born, and especially the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides it for us, mini urav, when you leave your mother's womb rather than from when you're conceived, is important about setting how we view man and how we view the essence of man. That's an interesting Rashi. Another interesting Rashi is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises Noach that anytime he wants to, Rashi fills in that any Vahaya Ba'anani, I'll read the Pasuk for you, it's in Pasuk Yud Beis, Zos Osabris Asherani Nosein Beini Uveinechem Ubein Kol Nefesh Chaya Asher Itchem Ladaros Olam. This is my deal, and essentially Es Kashti Nasati Bi'anan. I'm putting a rainbow, and it's more or less a circumscribed that any time my cloud gathers and I want to punish man, I'll remember the rainbow. So the rainbow is a corrective, is a halt, there's a reminder to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is Ladaros, this is forever. In Pasuk Yud Beis, Ladaros Olam. In Pasuk Yud Beis, Daros Olam is spelled without vavs. Lamed, Dalid, Resh, Taf. It should be spelled with at least one vav, here it's spelled without any vav. So why is the word Ladaros written chaser? So Rashi senses that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, even though most generations will require the pact of the rainbow, namely most generations may deserve divine intervention, but the rainbow will remind me of this covenant and I won't. There will be generations in history that will be so righteous that they won't need the rainbow. Maybe they will not see a rainbow, but they won't need the divine covenant of the rainbow. They won't need the Bris HaKeshes. So most of the generations will need this new setup, this new arrangement, but I may get disappointed and I may want to punish mankind, but the rainbow will remind me and hold me. But there will be generations that won't require, there'll be Kulam Tzadikim. What does Rashi say? Nichtav Chaser, Shiyesh Daro Shelohut Zecholios. There are some people that don't need a rainbow. Maybe they did or didn't see a rainbow, but Lefish et Tzadikim Gimurim Hayu, because they were so righteous. Which two generations does Rashi quote? So the first generation he quotes is the period of Chizkiah. Chizkiah led to a renaissance in Torah learning after many, many administrations that were corrupt, that rebelled against the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Chizkiah is like the last great white hope, Chizkiah and Yoshiyahu. But then the second generation Rashi quotes is Daru Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, the generation of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. What made that generation so unique? We don't have any documentation that during the period of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, they were so righteous, they were so scholarly, they were so pious. It was a regular generation. In fact, we see a lot of internecine struggle and fighting and civil war. What makes Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai's generation so special? The answer is there are mostly nefesh HaKadosh Hashem. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai lived through the Asara Rugei Malchus. He escapes the Asara Rugei Malchus. He escapes the sense that so many of his colleagues had to receive because he hides in the cave. His generation may not have been that righteous in their overall behavior, but they were mostly nefesh HaKadosh Hashem. And Rashi's holding out two templates for generations that can surpass previous generations in terms of their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and thereby not requiring this halt, covenant of the rainbow to halt HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem can't intervene, so to speak, because they're so righteous. One is people that study and learn are very pious. Two is people that are mostly nefesh HaKadosh Hashem to defend Hashem's presence in this world. When I read this Rashi, I'm thinking of our generation, of the Holocaust generation, particularly our generation, the Holocaust generation, these were victims who were involuntarily victims. Our generation, people who are mostly nefesh HaKadosh Hashem, they choose to live in Israel, they choose to serve in the army, they choose to defend the HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in this world. Keep in mind, this is also a statement reminding us in Noach that even though man is corruptible, man can still achieve perfection. There still could be generations that don't require this substandard fallen pack with the HaKadosh Baruch Hu or the rainbow. So it's an interesting Rashi because it reminds us that even though man had fallen precipitously, he could still achieve these very lofty heights of perfection without requiring the HaKadosh Baruch Hu's rainbow covenant. The third thing I want to discuss in Rashi, I just want to make sure we have enough time, very briefly, is the dove. The dove comes back after its second mission and it has an olive branch in its mouth. Why does it have an olive branch in its mouth? That's become the international symbol of peace. It's not really a symbol of peace here. What is it a symbol of? So Rashi says, I'll just paraphrase it because we don't have enough time to read it, that the bird chose an olive branch because olive wood is very bitter. And the dove was telling Noach, I'd rather have bitter food but have it directly delivered from HaKadosh Baruch Hu than sweet food that human beings provide. Now this is a very resonant statement in the context of the Teva, because for a year, man had lived without any contact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Normally, in normal conditions, you're waiting for rain, you're waiting for the harvest, you're earning a living, you're processing food. So at its best, you have that constant, steady interaction with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Will it rain? Will the harvest succeed? Will my stocks increase? Will my financials improve? But for a year, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was destroying humanity and wasn't really providing anything. And human beings had prepared all their needs ahead of time. So human beings had fallen into a state where they had very little contact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, certainly on their day-to-day. So this dove is restoring that balance. I would rather put bitter wood in my mouth than return to the teva and munch on some Cheerios or munch on some chocolate bars, because that bitter wood comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's a very important template for life, that sometimes it's better to have a lifestyle with a little less, or even a lifestyle that creates certain hardships, if you feel that lifestyle will put you in more direct contact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sometimes a lifestyle of too much luxury or too much convenience can detach you from HaKadosh Baruch Hu because it creates an insulated world. So it's an important model. Again, very, very general. You shouldn't choose experiences which are intentionally chas v'shalom hard or tragic or chalila v'chas. But sometimes when you create a calibration of your life, you shouldn't always be searching for the easiest. You should be searching for the lifestyle that can create the greatest contact points with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now what's interesting is that this Rashi reminds us that the Zionist tree is a bitter wood. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the dove is bringing back a Zayas piece of wood. It may or may not be talking, but certainly this is the communication that Noach receives. Does anyone know where else a piece of Zayas wood is seen as a bitter wood? It's a Medrash in Parshas B'Shalach. When they get to Shittim, the water is bitter. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs Moshe to take an eitz, vayireo eitz, and throw it into the water. According to one opinion in Chazal, Moshe took an olive wood, piece of an olive wood tree, just to highlight the miracle that bitter tree and bitter water can together create sweet water in the way that only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can devise. So essentially we have two statements in Chazal that attribute olive wood to being the bitterest wood, not necessarily the fruit, but the wood itself. Now what may be interesting, and this I'll say just very briefly, is this Medrash in Parshas Noach a general statement about sweet foods being less of a noble experience than non-sweet foods? Is this a underhanded critique of human beings needing to eat sweet foods all the time just to make their experience more pleasant rather than eating bitter foods that HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides, or for that matter, bitter foods that may be more healthy? Is this a quiet critique about the human beings? Is this essentially setting up a contrast between sweet foods being a sign of weakness and non-sweet foods being a sign of, at the very least, receiving your food from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not needing to satiate your palate, but being rather interested in other functions for food, recognizing the food is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, recognizing its internal health for your body? So, for example, the fact that you're not allowed to sacrifice anything sweet on the Mizbeach, and everything has to be salted, is that a further reinforcement of a dichotomy between sweet and non-sweet, which has certain moral connotations, not just what you want to eat? How does that play into the pasuk in Perek Yutes? Mesukim midvash. The Torah is compared to honey, which is as sweet as honey. So just, excuse me for the pun, some food for thought. Is this a quiet critique that the raven says, I would rather eat food that's bitter, but that has other values, in this case the value being from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, according to some dancers from Eretz Yisrael, from Har Mishra, rather than coming back to the teva and having a chocolate bar or a milkshake or something very, very sweet? This is especially in a world in which we eat a lot of sweet foods and we sweeten all of our foods and soda and sweet juices. Is this somehow reminding us that we should recalibrate our food habits? Okay, so three very interesting Rashis. Number one, that the Yetzirah only enters the human psyche or the human experience when you leave the mother's womb, min u'rav without a vav, Number two, that although the world had fallen into a very, very fragile state, there are generations that can surpass and re-achieve Gan Eden and don't need the rainbow. And one of them is a generation of Shimon Bar Yochai, who may or may not have been that pious, but were most in Evan Shekidosh Hashem. And then finally, the dove comes back after its second trip with a piece of olive wood, on the one hand, correcting a year of being insulated from Hashem, and possibly establishing bitter food, or at least non-sweet food, as a morally or even religiously superior form of eating. Okay, Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. Send regards.